The way we spend our time defines who we are. Jonathan Estrin.
Welcome to Meridians.
How often do you look at your clock? How often during the day do you count down the hours until quitting time? Or days until your next vacation? Or maybe you're counting down to retirement. At the end of the day, do you ask yourself if you spent your time well? I do, and as I reflect on today's episode, I'm wondering about this a lot. Am I doing something I'll be proud of? Am I working towards something? Or am I just going through the motions, just trying to keep myself above water? I'm Charlie Noble, and today we're going to talk about humanity's relationship with timekeeping and our pursuit of discovery in today's episode, From Timekeeping to Antarctica, The Human Drive for Wonder and Discovery. Okay, so let's talk about timekeeping. We're going on a quest today, and it's going to lead us eventually to Antarctica. First, timekeeping. And we'll talk more generally about keeping track of days and seasons at first. And then we'll talk about day-to-day timekeeping, like with a watch and your hour and everything. And we'll go on from there. I really want to dig deep on calendars and timekeeping if we can. Keeping time is just so basic and is ingrained throughout all cultures worldwide, pretty much anyway. It's so basic, if not more basic thing than the notion of creating fire. So let's go back, and I mean way back. Imagine you're an early human from like thousands of years ago. The sun rises and sets. The moon seems to change every night. The stars move throughout the night and change as the days go by, if ever slowly. You start to notice patterns. The weather seems to line up with how the sky looks at night, and the idea of seasons would just be inherently known as we evolved. Rituals around planting and harvesting become important traditions for teaching each other about seasons. Rituals and traditions around seasons would often be very practical ways for keeping a tribe or group cohesive and strong. Even human biology is tied to timekeeping, calendars, and seasons. Human bodies fit the seasons in Earth like a near-perfect puzzle piece. Our immune system tends to be more active in cold months. Our metabolism changes into fall to store more fat for the winter. Insulin levels change, and serotonin levels decrease in winter. Skin changes, sleep patterns change. And there's even higher rates of heart attacks in one season. Yes, you guessed it. Winter. So winter's obviously one of the most dangerous of seasons, it always has been, and our bodies have adapted to help us handle these winter months. In England, 900,000-year-old footprints and stone tools have been found, likely from Homo antecessor, a direct descendant of humans. They were recently found, actually, just in 2013. And England isn't as cold now, but 900,000 years ago, it was very cold there. During this period known as the early Pleistocene, the climate in Europe, including England, experienced extreme glacial conditions. So we humans and our ancestors have been experiencing the harsh realities of winter for a very long time. So then there's this slow evolution to us becoming humans and being humans. Of course, we looked up at the sky, and surely as seasons changed, humans made note of how the sky was different in different seasons. And the sky by day, showing the sun moving in a different path as the seasons changed, then at night there'd be constellations and movements of stars that would help teach people about what time of year it is. As larger groups of people gathered together, and in larger and larger societies, keeping time would surely become increasingly important. Personally, I wonder if the Homo antecessor who left those footprints 900,000 years ago were ancestors to the people who built Stonehenge. Hard to say, I wouldn't know. But Stonehenge was, in a way, a calendar. The first activity on Stonehenge site dates to 8500 to 7000 BCE. Hunter-gatherers had apparently erected some wooden posts in the area. The main construction of Stonehenge started around 3000 BCE and would continue to be worked on for 1,000 years. The site is believed to be a sort of religious and ceremonial site, but it also aligned to mark solstices and equinoxes, kind of like a sundial, but for seasons instead of the time of day. It could have also been used to honor ancestors or as a symbol of power. It was believed to have been built by hunter-gatherer societies, and it's so old that not much of a written history even exists about it. So now jumping thousands of years ahead to around like 400 BC, BC, BCE, I'm going to jump back and forth between those two because it really doesn't matter. You say BCE and it's like you're still referencing biblical Christ by having that reference point. So if you hear me say BC or BCE, just go with it, please. The Babylonians created the zodiac calendar, and the calendar divided the ecliptic into 12 zodiac signs. And by ecliptic, I mean the path that the sun traces across the sky over the course of a year. And those signs were really just formalized by the Babylonians. Having compiled the different signs over a great deal of time, some of the zodiac signs come from ancient Sumeria, such as Gemini and Cancer, though they may have changed what time period they represented over time. And settle down now. Keep your crystals in the drawer. We are sort of talking about astrology here, but in the historical context, not the horoscope that says your boyfriend was just not right for you because he's a Sagittarius and you're a Taurus. You need a man, not a boy, who can't sit still. Like, seriously. So obviously the signs of the zodiac have permeated our modern culture. And there's also this Chinese zodiac, which dates back to 220 BC. And their zodiac also has 12 signs, which is kind of interesting, although it's likely just a mathematical convenience that they both have 12 signs. 12 is considered a highly composite number. It can be divided up many ways, so this makes it a convenient number to settle on. So the two systems also differ in that the Western zodiac is based on the sun's annual path over the course of 1 year, and the Chinese zodiac is based on Jupiter's orbital period, which is just under 12 years. So both of these zodiacs are cute and have their place in history for their keeping track of time. However, the goat, the greatest timekeepers of the ancient world, for my money, goes to the Mayans and other Mesoamerican cultures that predate them. At least as far back as 2600 BC, these folks took their timekeeping very seriously. They had interconnected calendars that worked together and could track time over vast periods with great accuracy. They closely observed the movement of celestial bodies such as the stars, sun, moon, and planets. They had a particular interest in Venus, and they actually calculated the synodic period of Venus as 584 days, which is the time it takes for Venus to repeat the same position relative to the sun as seen from Earth. And they could accurately predict eclipses. They understood the lunar month. This stuff clearly meant a lot to them. And many other cities such as Edzna and Chichen Itza were constructed with buildings aligned to commemorate celestial events. Of course, there was their supposed 2012 prediction, which became famous for supposedly marking when the apocalypse would happen. This was mostly just sensationalist BS. December 21st, 2012, just marked the end of a 5,125-year cycle. There are thousands of Mayan texts that have been recovered. Only a few mention 2012, and none mention any kind of apocalypse. It's just nonsense. So their calendar seems to really be built off of civilizations that came before them, like the Olmecs, which are the oldest known civilization in Mesoamerica. And they date from around 1600 to 1500 BCE. And there isn't direct evidence of Olmecs having created calendars, but historians seem to mostly believe that the Olmecs did have some kind of calendar in their time. The Greeks were less organized, it would seem, than the cultures of Mesoamerica. They seem to have all kinds of different calendars from city to city. Most of them were based on lunar cycles and religious festivals. That would have to be a mess for record keeping of any kind. The records would be difficult to interpret outside of any given city, right? You'd have to travel 20 miles for a visit for a festival, only to find you were 2 days late. Not the Greeks' forte. For all the things that they're known for, this doesn't seem to be one of them. And the lunar cycle is mentioned there too. We've mentioned the lunar cycle a few times now, that cycle being 29.5 days. So that's basically where we get the concept of the month. And the year is based on Earth's orbit around the sun, of course, which Nicholas Copernicus would be credited for. And the Babylonians were tracking the sun across the Earth's sky, the ecliptic, to keep track of their zodiac year. So really, Copernicus was just making that more accurate to the Earth revolving around the sun. And he could demonstrate it, you know. And heliocentrism was around much earlier than the 1400s when Copernicus came along. A Greek astronomer, Aristarchus of Samos, created a heliocentric model around 310 to 250 BC. We don't really know exactly. There's also apparently a reference to heliocentrism in the 9th century BCE in an ancient Hindu text. So there's definitely been a lot of theories over the years, but what makes Copernicus so convincing was that he had some really good math to back up his claims. It wasn't just he actually had a way to demonstrate that it was true. So anyway, getting back to calendars, like I said, the year is based around the Earth's orbit around the sun. So a day is obviously the rising and setting of the sun, but really the rotation of the Earth. A month is derived from traditions based around the movement of the moon. So anyway, we understand the day, month, and year, but what about the week? For that, we need to go back to the Babylonians again. It's pretty underwhelming. I mean, their lunar cycle was 28 days, which is, you know, it's a day and a half off. But anyway, their lunar cycle was 28 days. So they'd want to divide those 28 days up. So they divided it by four and came up with seven. And the Babylonians associated the seven significant celestial bodies with each day of the seven-day period. So Monday would be for the moon, Tuesday was for Mercury, Wednesday was for Venus, Thursday was for Mars, Friday was Jupiter, Saturday was Saturn, and Sunday was the sun. They didn't use those words exactly, but they spread this seven-day week idea across the world. It would eventually catch on, obviously. And the Babylonians also marked the 7th, 14th, 21st, and 28th as special holy days, so you know Sunday. And the word holiday is straight up derived from holy day. And in the Old Testament of the Bible, of course, it's not certain that the Bible reference to the seven-day creation myth comes from Babylon, but it certainly could. The Babylonian creation myth, Enuma Elis, does not specifically mention a seven-day creation period, but does involve a structured creation process, which includes the establishment of order from chaos. Now, moving into the future from the Babylonians, the Romans knew how to do logistics. Man, it seemed like they were really good at organizing in general. And you can't have good logistics if the city next door has a different calendar than you. No, that's dumb. That's for the stupid fucking Greeks, not for the Romans. The Romans' early calendar, which is attributed to Romulus, the famed founder of Rome, was just 10 months in a year of 304 days. And they just sort of didn't count the winter months. I mean, genius, guys. Okay, maybe they weren't a ton smarter than the Greeks. But the Romans would just add and remove days as needed to keep the calendar aligned with the seasons. Kind of an odd to think in hindsight of doing that, but it probably seemed reasonable back then. This calendar didn't work very well. I fucking wonder why. Who gets to add the days and how does word spread? It's not like someone pushed out an update to everyone's tablet. I mean, stone tablet, that is. The calendar was apparently off by several months after a few years. It was just mismanaged, and clearly someone had to make a change. And yes, that someone actually mismanaged keeping track of days. Like that was your job, was to count every time the sun came up, and they screwed that up. So enter the Republican calendar. This would improve things somewhat. The names for the months that the Republican calendar used were in Januarius, Februarius, Martius, Aprilis, Maius, Lunius, Quintilis, Sextilis, September, October, November, and December. And it had 355 days, which was still about 10 and a fourth days shorter than the solar year. But hey, they were getting pretty close. It's a lot better than skipping a few months. But to keep it, the cool thing is to keep it aligned with the seasons, an intercalary month called Mercedonius was occasionally added, which that's cool. They had a bonus month. And I bet they had these ragers in that month when that month happened, just wine stained togas all over the place. And do you ever wonder how they got wine stains out of togas back then? I mean, they weren't just walking around with wine stains all over them, because you know what? Those are white togas and they got red wine. You know, they used piss. Yes, urine, because it had ammonia in it. So then they'd use this clay-like substance called Fuller's Earth to clean the clothes, and then sulfur bleach would be used. Chloroxus Maximus probably made a fortune in the toga cleaning game, I imagine. Anyway, finally, the Julian calendar was created, and this was put forth as a reform to the Roman calendar to make it more accurate. It consisted of 365 days and a leap year. Eventually, this would be replaced again by the Gregorian calendar, which is like 1500s. I don't know why I didn't put down when I replaced it, but it was around the 1500s. And that just improved accuracy by some margin as well. And that calendar is pretty much what we use today. Now, the modern Gregorian calendar has been widely used and almost universally reused around the world since its inception in the late 1500s. But there were other calendars that have been used and are still used besides that calendar. So the Islamic calendar is used in many Muslim countries alongside the Gregorian calendar. The Hebrew calendar, for similar reasons, is used. And then, of course, there's the Chinese calendar, which is still used in China for traditional holidays and cultural events. And then there's other countries use their own calendar. For example, Iran, they have an official calendar, which is considered one of the most accurate solar calendars. Ethiopia also has their own official calendar. North Korea has a calendar, which is basically the same as the Gregorian calendar, but has different years. They start with the birth year of Kim Sung II, the founder of North Korea. So in North Korea, you just subtract 1,911, and the year there is 113 when it's 2024 for everyone else. So that's cute for them. I'm sure that will help with the famine and total lack of freedom. And there are other calendars for other countries, but the Gregorian calendar is definitely the most widely adopted and used today. So now that we've covered timekeeping over days, weeks, months, and years, let's talk about day-to-day timekeeping. Sundials and shadow clocks would be used at least as long back as 3,500 years ago in Egypt and Mesopotamia. And that basically was designed to tell time as a shadow was cast by a totem or gnomon, all right, which basically was a tall object that could cast a shadow. And then different markings on the ground would indicate the time of day. I imagine that many people really just use whatever was around them. You know, it's not like you had a sundial. You're not carrying around a giant totem with you, you know. The sun's position in the sky would sort of give away the basic time of day, and you worked off the same place for a long time. You'd know how the shadows would cast when it's time to move on and head home. So things were made a little more sophisticated with water clocks and hourglasses to keep track of specific segments of time. They both basically use the principle of a fluid or sand moving at a constant rate to measure a specific amount of time. This made me think about time, though, as in seconds, minutes, and hours. I mean, like, who? Why? It actually goes back before the Babylonians this time. The Sumerians had a base 60 number system that they had developed. Again, because 60 is a highly divisible number. Then, of course, the Babylonians started using it for astronomical calculations and dividing time into units of 60, stuck, basically, from that point on. It's not actually definitely known, but is widely understood to likely evolve from this. And the 24-hour day goes from Egypt, who divided the day into 10 hours of daylight and 12 hours of nighttime. They also had a twilight hour at the beginning and end of daytime, so there you get that 12-hour clock. Sort of anyway, their hours varied in length with the seasons. Day-to-day timekeeping would undergo a similar evolution that the calendars went through over the years. So to keep time more steady for all of us, mechanical clocks would later be invented around 1270 to 1300 during the Renaissance period in southern Germany. And their invention was not really attributed to one person. I was a little disappointed. I was hoping for a guy named Bobby Clocksworth, but no, not the case. A mechanical clock consists of three components: the power, which would be like a weight or spring, a regulator, like a balance or a pendulum, and the escapement to actually rotate the wheel in a fixed interval. And the earliest mechanical clocks didn't even have any dials or hands, but told the time by striking bells. Necessity is the mother of invention, so what solution did these mechanical clocks solve? It was definitely more accurate than a water clock or an hourglass, which had been used for centuries by the time the mechanical clocks were invented. Large mechanical clocks would be placed in public or religious places to help a community keep on the same schedule. After all, an hourglass or water clock really just told you the relative time, whereas a mechanical clock ran continuously. Water clocks could technically run continuously as long as water was supplied, but they just weren't nearly as accurate. Also, a mechanical clock could be displayed for a large group of people to see and hear, in the case of bells, whereas with water clock, you'd probably have to be someone nearby who rang a bell or something, or a gong maybe, and a clock told you how close to the next hour you actually were. So people could really plan things out a lot better, you know? I kind of wonder if this time in history is really when human lives start to get more complicated, you know? I mean, imagine life before specific deadlines and clocks. A person's day-to-day life was allowed to be more complicated because they were more precise once you could use a clock. Once you could reference a clock, you could tell someone when to be somewhere. This concept of, you know, come tonight. Well, that's pretty simple. That's a broad range. But when you say come at 6 o'clock, well, that complicates my life. Anyway, everything, it's so the actual first recorded weight-driven mechanical clock was installed in 1283 at Dunstable Priory in Bedfordshire, England. The Roman Catholic Church was involved in this, actually. They had quite the history in timekeeping. I don't know if I failed to mention it earlier, but the Gregorian calendar was a product of the Catholic Church. The Church's interest in timekeeping with clocks was so that strict prayer time was observed by monastic orders. I guess I could see the need for that. I mean, let's say a couple of monks decide they're going to cut out early. You know, they're leaving the monastery with three stooges haircuts, you know, or whatever those guys had, and a priest stops them. "Where art thou going?" "Oh, hey, Bishop Pedophilus, we're just headed over to the night, out for the night. Got a lot of God stuff in today, you know?" Pedophilus replies, "Prayer time is not over yet." And he points to the giant fucking clock on the church tower. "It hasn't, oh, what? Sorry, I don't read clock yet. Our mistake." And, you know, random fact, the word clock comes from a Dutch word, klokke, which means bell. So the whole bells and clocks are quite tied together. The reference to bells would just be because early clocks were used to mark specific hours, like I said earlier, but before clock, they'd use the word horologe from Latin horologium, which is a combination of hour and to tell or count. Hora and legion. Legion, yeah. Portable clocks wouldn't come until the 16th century, and those would come about because of some engineering achievements. The invention of the mainspring in the early 15th century was a crucial development that made portable clocks possible. The mainspring provides a compact power source to replace the large weights used in earlier clocks. So when you wind a watch, you'd basically be tightening that mainspring. The earliest known portable clock was from around 1510. For many years, it was thought that the German clockmaker Peter Henlein invented the first portable timepiece in 1510. Sorry, Peter, apparently recent research has cast doubt on Henlein being the definitive inventor. Still, though, the oldest confirmed portable clock now appears to be one formerly owned by Philip Melanchthon, built in 1530, and it sounds like this may have been one of the clocks made by Henlein. So maybe he's my Bobby Clocksworth. I don't really know. These first portable clocks were still too large for pockets, though. They were worn as pendants around the neck called neck watches in Germany and chest watches in Italy and France. And if you just pictured Flava Flav, then we are on the same page. Flava Flav, that's right, the co-founder of Public Enemy, had albums go double platinum. Groundbreaking artist for his time. Some of his hit songs include Unga Bunga Bunga, Shake Your Booty, Flavor Man, and I'm Only Out for One Thing, among others. Look, he wore a big clock on his chest, you know? So it's just funny to me. Anyway, by 1524, that same Peter Henlein is recorded as having made what is thought to be one of the earliest examples of a wristwatch. So in the 1500s, you weren't about to bop down to Kmart and pick up a sweet Timex watch and the latest Public Enemy album. That would, of course, come much later. No, in the 1500s, watches would mostly be worn by nobility and the wealthy elite. Probably custom-made with some sweet monograms or family crests or something, you know. So regular common folk were still relying on those church bells or the town square clock to let them know the time. Well, what about cuckoo clocks then, huh? Yeah, what about them? Well, those apparently came from the Black Forest region of Germany. It's actually kind of uncertain who made the first cuckoo clock, but it seems to be a clock that belonged to a German Prince Elector August von Sachsen. Cuckoo clocks are actually mostly associated with Switzerland, but were most surely invented in Germany in the 1600s. And these would be mass-produced by the mid-1700s and are among some of the earliest mass-produced clocks ever. I thought they were more of a novelty, but apparently they were a big hit back then, and apparently they were produced by farmers in the winter months as a supplemental income. They'd use their woodworking skills along with their knowledge of the cuckoo mechanism. And this is the cuckoo mechanism. There's the clock movement. This is the heart of the cuckoo clock, driving all its functions. It includes gears and a pendulum that regulate the time of the clock. A bellows. There are two bellows inside the clock, each responsible for producing part of the cuckoo call. These bellows were operated by the mechanical movement of the clock. Whistles. The bellows push air through small whistles, creating the distinct cuckoo sound. Each bellow produced a different tone, combining to mimic the call of a cuckoo bird. The automated bird. The cuckoo bird is a carved figure that pops out of a small door in the clock. It is connected to the clock movement by wires and levers. When the clock strikes the hour, the movement triggers the bird to emerge, often accompanied by wing flapping and beak opening actions. You can imagine farmers exchanging notes and like trying to outdo each other, you know, with all these little mechanical engineering ideas they had. It sounds like a good time, honestly. Wife making Black Forest cherry cake while you and the guys are drinking that German beer, building fucking clocks in the basement. I mean, sign me up. And your grandfather clocks and wall clocks with pendulums all started to be produced and sold to wealthier individuals, more like a another couple hundred years later or so in the 1700s. So then now we get to the 1800s. Those come along, and along with them, the Industrial Revolution. And there would be two things that I'd like to point out about this time regarding timekeeping. Firstly, it seems like this was the time that more and more common people would begin to have clocks. They might not have some fancy chest clock or wristwatch, but they probably have a wall clock or a shelf clock or some kind of clock they kept in their home. And then in the late 1800s, the Industrial Revolution saw the invention of the alarm clock. Clocks built so that people could wake up and start their shift at the factory. Isn't that nice? I wonder who invented that. In a previous episode, I said the Gutenberg press was one of the best inventions in human history. Well, I think alarm clocks, I think they're the exact opposite. I mean, fuck them. Why? Why do we need to go so fast? Why? It seems like the more we keep track of time, the less we enjoy the time we have. I know living our fast lives has done a lot of good for technological progress and advancing civilization, but at some point, something's got to give. I think human psyche needs a break. A revolution to slow down would be great. Sounds kind of good, doesn't it? Where the hell am I going with this? Not anywhere useful. I know. So on our march to Antarctica and the South Pole, this isn't taking us there. So that's where we should be headed. It's time to start diverting towards our goal. So let out the mainsail and go hard to port as we transition away from timekeeping. And here's my thin segue, but I found this interesting, so here we are. Clocks on boats. There was a time when a sand glass or clock or timepiece would be crucial to have on a boat for navigation. At least since the 14th century, probably earlier, a marine sand glass would be used to help measure a boat's speed and knots. Most boats back then would have a chip log, and the chip log consisted of a wooden board attached to a line with knots tied at regular intervals. While the ship was moving, the chip log would be thrown overboard and the line would begin to unspool. As the line was unspooling, a sand glass would be flipped and the sand would drain to the bottom. Once the sand was emptied from the top, once to the bottom of the sand glass, the rope would be stopped and the number of knots that had passed on the rope would be counted. This would indicate the speed of the boat, usually recorded in nautical miles or knots. Many boats used sand glass into the 1800s until they were phased out by mechanical timepieces or other ways to measure knots. Knowing the boat's speed and then also having a clock to keep track of time would be crucial in calculating the distance a boat had traveled as well. This way, a captain could understand where they were in the water without any sight of land. I find it quite amazing how well navigators could find their way before modern technology. It makes you wonder how this developed. Who developed these navigation techniques? Who made the maps? And how did they do that? How'd they make the maps? Well, let's try to answer that question in our next segment about cartography, map making, and navigation. The Babylonian, of course, map of the world comes to us from the 9th century BC from, of course, Babylon. It's a clay tablet that's only about 5 by 3 inches, so it's not very big at all. This map is the oldest known depiction of the known world. The map is centered on the Euphrates River and shows the city of Babylon in the northern half and the city Susa is in the south. It has a few other locations and landmarks on it. The map looks like it was really used for display or something. It doesn't seem like it would really be used for any kind of navigation. The map itself was circular with some writing above it. While this map doesn't seem useful, it's possible that other maps just didn't survive because they weren't carved into stone, you know? We may never know, unfortunately. What we do know is that a few hundred years later, in the 6th century BC, Anaximander of Miletus would create one of the first maps of the known world. This map was circular in design also, and it represented the entire inhabited land known to the ancient Greeks at the time. This map was improved several decades later by Hecateus, the two men likely never met, as Hecateus was, He'd have been a small child when Anaximander died, but Hecatius did improve on Anaximander's map independently. The map shows the Mediterranean region, Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Greece, and Italy, and they're easy to spot. And this map looks pretty legit. They have coastlines with some detail. If you've ever looked at a world map, you'd instantly know what it's depicting, what this map is depicting. It's very much the Mediterranean region. And Anaximander likely incorporated information from different cartographers from across these regions. So it sounds like he gathered a bunch of smaller maps and cross-referenced them and made more comprehensive map out of them. Later, Hecatius would be building off of his map by even adding more information and detail to the world map. And for that work, Hecatius is referred to as the father of geography for his work in this field. And so I guess that makes Anaximander, who he basically improved upon, the granddad of geography, I'd suppose. This map did have a practical purpose. It was used to improve navigation and trade among the Greek colonies around the Mediterranean and Black Seas. This is all great, but I still want to understand, how did these original cartographers map the coastlines and locations so well? How'd they actually do it? Well, the answer seems to be some good math and a hell of a lot of work. Honestly, if I'm not going to go back and be a cuckoo clock maker farmer, being a cartographer sounds kind of cool as well. You get to travel, hang out with your buddies, working on an important project. Most importantly, if you screw something up, who's going to say you're wrong? I guess other cartographers, but I don't know. It seems like a neat gig. Anyways, so math in particular, triangulation was pretty key in their measurements. They would take a known point and draw it on the map. Using a compass for direction and a theodolite for measuring angles, you could find the relative position of different structures by triangulating them. Distance would be crucial in making these calculations work. So what if I didn't know how far I was from landmark A? Well, if you know your speed and walk from a certain point for a certain amount of time, you could calculate the distance. So then you'd have the distance, angles, and direction. From there, it would just be a very careful, repetitive process to put the right landmarks in the right places. I would imagine they'd have to just go over the same area several times from different positions to make sure they put the landmarks in the right locations on the map. But once you've placed enough landmarks and know the distance between them, I imagine it would start to get easier because you have more information to go off of. And unless you screwed up somewhere along the way, those initial measurements would probably have a huge effect on how accurate the resulting map would be. Coastlines would create a specific kind of problem. Coastlines, being fractal in nature, would have ever more detail the smaller the scale you're measuring. A cartographer would kind of need to have an idea of what scale of measurement on a coastline they were going to put on their map. Basically, finding the average angle of a direction over a set distance. And coastline could and would be measured by boat and also sometimes by foot. A boat actually creates a good way to measure because navigators would already be needing to know their direction and speed, which would help them calculate the distances between points on a coastline. They just need that fixed position to go off of. Even with all that work and detail, miscalculations would just throw off the whole coastline, So for a map to be accurate, it seems like it would take several passes and recalculations. Also, there were certainly issues of making sure a point on the map was in fact the point that they were looking at. Navigators would often be looking for hills, mountains, and unique rock formations, clusters of trees, or distinct vegetation. Even the coastline shape and contours would sort of help. For marking points in the ocean, though, that's interesting. They would look for like kelp forests or schools of jellyfish or like certain whale pods. That can't be super accurate in the term of the whale pods. I don't think they're staying in the exact same place all the time, but sometimes they would use depth measurements with lead lines as well. This would be important for identifying shallow areas as well, or areas that should be avoided, like a coral reef or underwater rocks. Now, the phrase Dead Reckoning popped up in my research, and I want to go down a fairly quick blind alley on that. It's not going to take us where we're going, but it'll get us in the right frame of mind, I think. So let's talk about Dead Reckoning more broadly and how sailors were able to find their positions at sea. Okay, I've definitely heard the phrase dead reckoning before. This isn't a Mission Impossible movie, right? I mean, okay, yeah, the one where Tom Cruise goes off book and the Impossible Mission Force is actually after Tom Cruise. Wait, that's like every one of those movies. I don't get why do they keep doing that? I didn't realize dead reckoning was actually a navigational technique. It's used to calculate the current position of a moving object. You know, likely a boat based on a previously known position. It incorporates estimates of speed, heading, and elapsed time. It's a method that's been used for centuries for navigation and even land and air travel as well. You take a starting point or an assumed position, then the compass heading or direction of the boat would need to be noted, and then the speed and time spent traveling from the known assumed position. So if I know I'm right off the coast of Miami, heading southeast, and I've been traveling for 1 hour at X speed, I should be able to chart where I'm at. Pretty simple if you're just going straight. But sailboats don't travel in straight lines for long, or at all, hardly. Sailboats often have to change heading. So back to that constant timekeeping and measuring speed and direction every time the boat changes course. This stuff was super crucial in navigating these old boats. Since each course change would have to reference that previous position, any mistakes in timing, direction, or speed in the rest of the voyage would be off, unless until they could find a new point of reference, of course. Fortunately, a sailor could use a universal reference point to help. So Polaris, the North Star, could be used to find where they were by checking the angle between the star and the horizon to figure out the ship's latitude. And the Southern Cross in the Southern Hemisphere would be used in the same way, and latitude being the position north or south. And now figuring out the longitude, that's much more difficult. However, in the 1700s, to go back to clocks, a guy named John Harrison would create the marine chronometer. And this was basically just a special clock that kept track of time, typically in Greenwich, England, at least for British sailors anyway. Sailors would then note that time that the sun was highest in the sky, so noon, and that time difference from the marine chronometer would help them locate where they were in time relative to Greenwich. Since the Earth rotates 15 degrees per hour, sailors could convert the time difference into degrees of longitude. So for every hour of distance, it was 1 degree of longitude east or west. The problem with this is that you're measuring the latitude at night and the longitude during the day. So again, they just really need to become careful with recording and taking all this into account. Before this marine chronometer, dead reckoning looked like it was the most accurate they were going to get at the right position. So okay, let's get back on track now. So hopefully that dead reckoning makes sense. Okay, so now we've been talking a lot about boats, so that kind of primes us for our next topic, as we're going to talk about some explorers who ventured south by boat into treacherous waters and dangerous terrain. Antarctica wasn't discovered and landed on in one voyage. It was a sort of a gradual process, really. Ancient Greek philosophers had postulated the existence of a southern continent to balance out the northern Arctic, though they certainly didn't have the means to reach Antarctica, and no voyage that long ago has ever been recorded, not even close. So now conspiracy gurus might say, well, what about the Perry Rees map from 1513? This map was created by a cartographer in 1513 by a man named Perry Rees. He claimed to have used 20 source maps and charts to create his map, which included North and South America, Europe, Africa, and the Atlantic Ocean. The detail on South America is particularly good, apparently. The hubbub with this map, though, is that it has a line that actually extends down past from the southern tip of the coast of South America and loops down and sort of borders the bottom of the map. The half-baked theory is that the map shows the coastline of Antarctica before it was covered in ice. However, there's two problems with this. The line doesn't really match the coastline of Antarctica with or without ice. And Antarctica has been covered with ice for millions of years. The sheet currently covering the surface is 34 million years old. No mainstream research supports this theory that the Peary Reese map shows the Antarctic coastline. It's a joke. It's ridiculous. It's again fun to think and spark your imaginations so the conspiracy crowd won't let it go. Despite thin to no evidence that the theory holds any merit whatsoever. And personally, I don't see any reason a person shouldn't look into that map further, fine, but stick to the facts. Maybe the truth of that map is more interesting and it has nothing to do with Antarctica, you know? Oftentimes, reality is more interesting than the stupid conspiracies that get cooked up anyway. Anyway, getting back to reality, Antarctica would first be sighted in 1820, twice by two different countries' expeditions. The Russian expedition led by Fabian Gottlieb von Bellingshausen would get the credit for spotting the Antarctic coast January 27, 1820, followed 3 days later by Edward Bransfield of Britain, whose expedition independently sighted the Antarctic coastline. How did they end up making these sightings 3 days apart? Well, it's partly just by chance, but also because improved naval technology allowed the ships to survive harsher conditions. Von Bellingshausen's detailed account of the expedition was only published 10 years later, too, so he didn't really get much credit for this. And really, Bransfield's discovery wasn't even noted as being a big achievement by the British Admiralty. Also, Bransfield never even published any account of his voyages, so neither one of those knuckleheads get much credit, but that's weird. It's just a weird way to discover something. There's like, oh, there's something there. All right, cool, moving on. No, nobody cares? Okay, neither do I. Anyway, they move. I don't understand why that wasn't, like, significant. But neither of these guys actually made landfall anyway, though. It wasn't until a year later when American sealing captain John Davis would land at Hughes Bay in the Antarctic Peninsula on February 7th, 1821. So basically a year later. And you can bet that John Davis was not aware of either of the previous sightings of Antarctica at all. And this guy's claim isn't confirmed either, so he doesn't get any credit for Antarctica. The only undisputed champion of the first settled foot on Antarctica would be none other than, well, actually, wait, that's not confirmed either, but what we do know is that for sure, a Norwegian whaling and sealing vessel led by Henrik Bull landed at Cape Adare. From this boat, the contenders for the first people to have set foot on Antarctica soil are Karsten Borchgrevink, Captain Leonard Christensen, and Alexander von Trunzelmann. The first two were from Norway, and Alexander was from New Zealand. And all these men made landfall within seconds of each other, so they should all get credit, really. I mean, come on. It's pretty widely thought that they weren't the first people to set foot on Antarctica anyway. I mean, it was 1895, and there had been sealing and whaling being done in the area for decades at this point. So it's believed that no one found it significant and just didn't record it or take credit. They probably thought it was just another island, you know, and that now that someone has made landfall, though, I want to add a few details to Antarctica to help paint a picture of what it's like there, besides just the obvious that it's cold and snowy. Though it is cold, so damn cold. I mean, it can get to negative 110 degrees below zero inland during the winter. But in the summer, the coastal regions can get up to about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Though that's only like for a few days and in certain places. But during the winter months, the ice freezes off the coast and extends out for many miles. Most of the continent is freezing year-round as well. So And that's probably why 98% of Antarctica is covered in ice. And this kind of blew my mind. I had no idea. But the ice is roughly 1 mile thick on average. And that ice actually makes up 70% of the fresh water on Earth. The ice is so heavy that there are parts of the continent that have been pushed below sea level. I had to read that about 5 times because I couldn't hardly believe it. But yeah, that's insane. And that ice is just full of hazards, by the way. Crevasses, which are caused by ice moving and separating, leaving sometimes very deep chasms. And some of these chasms get hidden below the snow, which is an extremely hazardous part of traveling across Antarctica. These crevasses seem to be everywhere. And the transatlantic mountains then divide the continent east and west, having some peaks over 13,000 feet. And there's even a few active volcanoes on a couple different islands off the coast. And all that ice stacked atop a continent makes Antarctica, it's also the tallest continent by average. The icebergs, coastal regions, and sea around Antarctica are actually quite filled with life, too. It's not a rainforest by any stretch of the imagination, but there's mosses, lichens, and liverworts. There are even a few flowering plants, Antarctic hairgrass and Antarctic pearlwort. The hairgrass just looks pretty much like your lawn, kinda. And the pearlwort is a neat little green spongy-looking blob, though. Like, kind of like moss is what it kind of looked like, but it was kind of like a blob. It looked kind of neat. And as far as animals go, you've got your seals, penguins, fish, of course, squid, krill, and different species of plankton are all part of the region's food chain. There's even several different species of whales living in the Southern Ocean, which surrounds Antarctica. And speaking of, the Southern Ocean can be very difficult to travel through. In the summer months, sailors can expect rough seas and temperatures in 20s and 30s Fahrenheit. Yikes. It's also incredibly windy with large swells. Drake's Passage, which is the area of the ocean between South America and Antarctica, is considered one of the most difficult parts of the ocean to cross. And this is due to the strong currents and aggressively large waves, some of which reach 40 feet high. Yikes. Now that we know a little bit about the continent and how much the ocean around Antarctica sucks, let's talk about the goofballs that tried to reach the South Pole first. The year is 1901. Finally, the public in general starts to gain interest in the idea of Antarctic exploration. This leads to the Discovery Expedition put together by the British Royal Society and the Royal Geographical Society. But there was also a German expedition, a French expedition, and a Swedish expedition, all heading to find the continent south of the Indian Ocean. The British expedition was led by Robert Falcon Scott. I wanted to mention his name because he's a key player in the race to the South Pole later. And the interest in Antarctica seems kind of like an early version of the space race to me. Not quite the same, but it was peacetime and there was a lot of competition to explore Antarctica and also to reach the South Pole. I wish we had something like that these days. I don't know, something to bring people together, even if competitively. Who knows? I mean, I guess we have the Olympics, right? Anyway, the Discovery Expedition, it set off on the boat, the Discovery, on August 6, 1901, from the Isle of Wight in UK. They arrived in Cape Adare in Antarctica in 1902. So now it's been about 5-6 months at sea. They sailed down the Antarctic coast from there. And you can imagine this ship's probably a fairly sober, somber boat. You know, it's cold as hell. They've had a long journey, and it seems pretty serious. It seems like Scott is a pretty serious man, so I assume the boat was pretty professional and a mature environment. And they're probably very busy navigating and mapping and documenting what they can. It isn't part of a scientific expedition after all. And then February 4th of 1902, Robert Falcon Scott would ascend like his namesake. No, but for real though, these guys brought a balloon with them, apparently. It was an observation balloon, and Scott himself climbed up on the balloon and ascended 600 feet in the air while the balloon was tethered firmly to the ship. The third officer of the ship, named Ernest Shackleton, would follow and go up on the second flight. Unfortunately, neither saw much. It was just endless nothing. Not much to see. God, it must have been cold as shit up there. And they didn't have any Gore-Tex back then, you know? The Discovery then turned westward and on the 8th of February entered McMurdo Sound. They would anchor at a spot near the southern limit of the sound at an area which would later be named Winter Quarters Bay. So like the name suggests, the team would then hunker down for a while, like quite a while. They were initially going to camp on land, even build a hut, but then decided best to stay on the boat. They let the boat freeze in the ice and stayed there through the winter. They made a little home for themselves there. Shackleton even ran his own little newspaper, the South Polar Times. By November 2 of 1902, Scott, Shackleton, and another member of their crew set off across the ice to get as far south in a straight line on the barrier ice as we can, reach the pole if possible, or find some new land. This would be a very brave and difficult journey. They suffered frostbite, scurvy. They had to kill the weaker of their sled dogs to feed the other slightly less weak sled dogs that were with them. Eventually, all the dogs died. Shackleton had a particularly bad case of scurvy. They did, however, make up farther south than anyone had before at 82 degrees south, but still they were 500 miles from the South Pole. They were barely able to make it back to the boat on February 3rd, 1903. So damn, they were out there for 3 months. They crossed 960 miles. I know they had sled dogs, but with the conditions they were in, well, they didn't have them for long, but with the conditions they were in, though, it was the warmer months. Temperatures were still well below freezing, though. It's 10 miles per day on unmapped terrain. That's pretty wild. While Scott and Shackleton had been gone, a relief boat had come and resupplied the Discovery. This relief would have been short-lived, as it was clear, though, that the Discovery was going to be stuck in the ice for another winter. However, they were resupplied, at least, and some crew had the opportunity to return home. One of these crew that returned home would be Shackleton. He didn't want to go, but Scott made the decision not to further risk Shackleton's health after the difficult winter he had endured. So Shackleton gone, we'll learn about much more about him later, Scott had another expedition on to the ice, which went relatively well despite Scott falling into a crevasse and nearly dying, but later they found land not covered by snow and ice, and this is an area known as the McMurdo Dry Valleys. They also moved even faster, covering 700 miles this time in 59 days round trip, which was even faster than the previous year's expedition. And they did that without sled dogs. So now this year, we're in 1903 now, a second relief expedition arrives. They've got two ships and also a mandate that either they free the Discovery from the ice or leave her there and return home on the relief ship. Freeing the ship from the ice was not a small feat. The ship was 20 miles from open water. They started sawing, dynamiting, and working constantly. They had nearly given up. And then suddenly on February 14th, hey, Valentine's Day, February 14th, and the ice broke, and the Discovery would go home. There was public excitement, promotions handed out. They made great scientific discoveries, having found the Dry Valleys, an emperor and penguin colony. They found a leaf fossil. They had thousands of biological samples. So truly it was a successful expedition. Scott would write a book about this experience called The Voyage of the Discovery, published in 1905. And this would actually create a rift between Shackleton and Scott, as Shackleton didn't like the way he was portrayed during the first expedition. Scott would go on to be a national hero for a while. Ernest Shackleton himself would actually go on to lead his own attempt to the South Pole. He made it as far as 88 degrees south, only 97.5 miles from the pole. Damn. And this expedition, though not entirely successful, would make Shackleton very famous. He would be remembered for his expeditions as for his contributions to explorations in science. And on that expedition on the way home, I believe, is when his boat crashed and he had to be saved. And he was barely saved, is from what it sounded like. But yeah, his boat has just recently been found, I believe. I think I saw in the news a few years ago. I should have researched that along with this. But anyway, we're not going to talk too much more about Shackleton, because he gets, you hear about Antarctica and then you hear about Shackleton's voyage, and it's, you know, I want to hear, there's another story to it than that, than Shackleton's voyage down. So anyway, we'll move on from Ernest. Now let's jump to 1910 and talk about the final race to the South Pole. Semifinals are over. It's time for the Super Bowl of expeditions, the championship for the ages, as you might say. 1910 was a busy year for Antarctic explorers. There were three teams from three different countries that set out that year. There was Roald Amundsen and his crew, who were from Norway. There was a British crew led by Robert Falcon Scott. And there was a Japanese explorer, Nobu Shirase. And before we talk about Scott and Amundsen more, I want to focus on and pay some respect to Shirase. Nobu Shirase was a Japanese army officer turned explorer. He had experience in the cold, having ventured north with an expedition to the northern Kuril Islands, which were north and west of Japan. This sparked an interest in him to reach the North Pole first, with that title going to Robert Perry in 1909, though, Shirase set his sights on the Antarctic region. Shirase would try to get support from the Japanese government for his expedition, but there just wasn't any interest. They weren't going to fund his expedition. Instead, he organized funding privately and set out in 1910 on the Kainan Maru, which was a converted fishing boat. The expedition stalled out on the first attempt to reach Antarctica, though, and Shirase and his crew were forced to winter in 1911 in Australia. Nuts. However, they did set out again in 1912 and would be the first to land on King Edward VII Land. That's the island is King Edward VII Land. So King Edward VII's land? I don't know. King Edward VII Land. I don't know. It's one of those. Anyway, the expedition didn't have any great scientific discovery, but it was only the fourth group to cross the 80 degree parallel to the south. Considering it was privately funded, it's pretty cool. Upon his return, him and his crew were greeted as heroes, but the fame quickly wore off and he didn't get any real recognition outside of Japan. He was then burdened with a bunch of debt from funding his voyages, and he would die in relatively obscure poverty in 1946. Shirase might not have made it to the South Pole or made any great discoveries, but still I think he deserves a lot of credit for having vision, putting everything on the line, and doing something extraordinary. He would later receive more recognition from the Japanese government, and it's now more widely recognized for his achievements, as I should be, I think. Now on to the race to the South Pole. On the British side, there was Robert Falcon Scott with the ship Terra Nova, which is a very badass name for a ship. Anyway, he had with him 65 men, several of which were veterans of the expedition, Discovery expedition, that is, and Shackleton's expedition from a few years earlier. So they had themselves some fairly experienced crew. On the Norwegian side, though, they were led by Roald Amundsen, an experienced sailor and Arctic explorer. The ship named the Fram was experienced itself and had been used by Fridtjof Nansen to traverse the Arctic in 1893. Amundsen would have experienced naval lieutenants as his expedition officers as well. His crew was very experienced with cold weather, but they were much smaller crew. They only had 19 men on his ship, whereas Scott had 65 men. So the British ship, Terra Nova, sailed from Cardiff on June 15th, 1910. Scott wasn't even on board when they initially departed, though, being held up by Expedition Business, probably still trying to raise money at the last minute. I found that kind of weird. I've understood morale to be kind of a big thing on boats, as men are isolated and needed to rely on each other, you know? For the captain to not be present from the outset, totally just speculating here, but I wonder if that didn't really sit well with the crew. I don't know. Who knows? He didn't join up with the ship until South Africa, though, having caught up with them by way of passenger liner. So, captained by Roald Amundsen, the Norwegian ship Fram set off late July of 1910. And here's a teeny little note about Amundsen. Not a big deal, but Amundsen was originally going to the North Pole, but like Shiraze, but he was beaten by Robert Perry. Of course, you know, like I said, Shiraze was beaten by Robert Perry as well. Without telling most of his crew, though, he changed his plans and decided to go to the South Pole. His investors and the public had no idea and wouldn't for weeks or months. And Amundsen's crew reached Funchal in the city in the autonomous region in Portugal on September 6th of 1910. So they went from England to Portugal, and, you know, his crew thought they were going to the North Pole. Finally he let his crew know of his deceit. I'm sure they were wondering why they were going south, and allowed them to get off the boat from here if they didn't want to continue their journey to the South Pole. Aware of Robert Falcon Scott's plan for the South Pole, Amundsen sent a telegram to Melbourne, Australia, informing Scott of the change Amundsen was making. However, Amundsen was vague and didn't explicitly tell Scott that he would be heading to the South Pole. Scott, not being a dummy, knew that the race was on now for damn sure. He had to. Eventually, word got back to Norway of Amundsen's deceit as well. He would be condemned by the press at the time, and of course, Britain reacted adversely as well. The funding for his expedition would basically now dry up while he was already underway. The Fram, however, would sail on, not knowing how the world had reacted. So while it's possible that Scott might have angered his crew by not being present for the entire voyage, again, I'm just totally speculating, it's certain that Amundsen ruffled some feathers and angered a few crew, having definitely tricked them. At least he only went all across Europe before telling them. And yes, it's noted that the crew were definitely wondering if we're going to the North Pole, why are we going to Portugal? It had to be an awkward or hell first few weeks on that boat to deceive the crew like that to start your trip. Both of them had kind of weird ways to start their trips. But the British Terra Nova ship arrived in Antarctica in January 4th, 1911, where they arrived off Ross Island. The main party would then unpack and set up camp at Cape Evans. Scott brought with him a prefabricated accommodation hut. He's always got to bring stuff. This hut was 50 by 25 feet, and it sounds like some kind of neat little IKEA Sears and Roebuck DIY house. I mean, I don't know. I don't get it with this guy. He's got to have a party trick for every single trip he goes on. I mean, it was the balloon first and now this. I love it. Anyway, Scott then sent a team on a smaller boat to carry out scientific work, and this team would attempt to land on King Edward VII Land, but would be unsuccessful in doing so. See, Shiraze definitely deserves some credit, as he would be successful in landing the following year. Meanwhile, the Fram had sighted the first icebergs on New Year's Day 1911. By January 14th, Fram was in the Bay of Whales. Amundsen and his crew were very familiar with and relied heavily on sled dogs. Being a more northern country, the Norwegians surely had an advantage for handling the cold. They reportedly had 100 sled dogs with them, working in teams of six. They used these dogs to set up a base near the bay, where they would create a base to stage their attempt on the South Pole. Unlike Amundsen by comparison, Scott's party had a mixed of transportation strategy. Having had dogs fail on him in the Discovery Expedition, he decided to rely on a combination of dogs, motor sledges, and ponies. So back to Scott's British Science Party that went off on that separate boat, they continued to find a place to land and would eventually meet up with Amundsen's crew at Amundsen's base. They were apparently very courteous and hospitable with each other, and the Norwegians allowed Scott's team to camp nearby for a few days. More on that separate science team in a bit. Amundsen himself, he was very calculating. His main base was near the boat and was stocked with food, while they spent February of 1911 starting to organize depots on their way to the South Pole. These depots would allow Amundsen and his team to not have to carry as much food all along the way. It also allowed him and his men to train and plan for the ultimate journey south. They would lay out three depots over the course of a few months. These journeys brought them south of the 80 degree parallel and even made it to the 82 degree south spot. The depots would have 7,500 pounds of supplies each. And Robert Falcon's team would also be laying depots of their own, though they had started out in January, and Scott would end up getting his depot set up, but with his farthest south depot only getting to 79 degrees south. So I said 82 degrees south was Amundsen's farthest south depot, and that's a big difference in miles. So, and they lost all but two of their ponies in the process. Robert Falcon Scott did, getting to that 79th parallel depot. So they only ended up with two ponies. It turns out that bringing a bunch of jackasses to Antarctica wasn't such a great idea. Scott made it back, but only after having to rescue a dog team that had fallen into yet another crevasse. And Scott's Terra Nova expedition crew would then settle at Camp Evans for the winter in their prefabricated hut. They kept themselves busy, though, with scientific work, and they overhauled their equipment. These dorks even held regular lectures teaching each other about Japan, sketching, horse management, and they had a geologist with them that taught them about volcanoes. They would even keep up with their physical fitness by playing games of football. I mean, soccer, if you speak American, you know. They even resurrected Shackleton's old newspaper, the South Polar Times. Feels like these nerds just set up their own college for the winter. I mean, good for them, but I didn't see that coming. Like the Terra Nova crew, Amundsen and his team had to wait out the winter at their base by the bay, which became known as Framheim. Through this whole expedition, Amundsen and his crew would eat much seal meat. This would stave off scurvy and keep them fed. And Amundsen and his crew spent a few months working with their dogs, getting used to their gear. Now they had time to sit tight, prepare the equipment and food. So they seemed to spend a good deal of winter improving their equipment and preparing for the journey. And in preparation for the journey south to the South Pole, the Fram was instructed to leave and resupply in Buenos Aires and then return as soon as possible in 1912. Pretty gutsy move to leave them behind, though. Again, he just seems very calculated and he's just well thought out. They needed supplies and he thought very far ahead and had them knew they needed to go and get them. So the Terra science crew that I had mentioned that had separated and met up with Amundsen, they ended up having some difficulty themselves and had to survive in a snow cave through the 1912 winter. Jesus. They wouldn't hook back up with the main Terra Nova party until November of 1912. And Scott's team, being a larger crew and having and focused more on scientific advancement, they ended up having several other expeditions to various areas. And I want to stay focused on the hunt south, though. So I'm going to, we won't talk about many of those offshoot little expeditions they had, but Amundsen and his crew had prepared for the journey south by reading books previously published by other explorers. Amundsen also had extensive training with dog sleds. He had learned from the Inuit people themselves during a previous expedition to the Northwest Passage, and his dogs proved very critical on the journey. But Amundsen had heard word of Scott having motorized sledges, and this put fear in him that Scott might beat him to the South Pole. And if you're Amundsen and you're probably thinking this Scott guy should know what he's doing since he's been here before and presumably more prepared, so this prompted Amundsen to leave September 8th, 1911 from Framheim and start the trek to the South Pole. So now 8 men, including Amundsen, would set off south with their sled dogs, and they made good initial progress, making 15 miles in the first day. It was actually more difficult for the crew when they stopped at night. Not moving and remaining still meant they would be cold and miserable. By September 12th, the party had to halt. The temperature was negative 69 degrees Fahrenheit. They ended up building igloos for shelter. Wonder if they learned that from the Inuit as well, but anyway, they clearly left too early. Soon they turned around and headed back to Framheim. They did, however, leave behind a good deal of supplies at one of their depots, so the trip wasn't a total loss. It just ended up being a depot delivery instead of the actual expedition south. You know, just kidding. On the way back to Framheim, for some reason, Amundsen left 2 men behind who were going slower, and then they got separated. 17 hours later, when the 2 late arrivals finally made it back, one was fuming mad and the other was badly frostbitten on their feet. Apparently, their sled dogs had failed on them, so maybe Amundsen's sled dog got a little farther ahead. This led Amundsen to exclude some of the men from the next attempt to the South Pole. So now it would be 5 men traveling south. They were smart this time and waited until October 19th, 1911, before starting south once more. This journey went much better, and they covered nearly 15 miles a day and made it to their 82 degrees south depot by November 5th. The Terra Nova crew began their journey on October 24th. There were to be 16 men initially in their crew, and they would all go to the base at Beardmore Glacier. The motor sledge crew nearly immediately ran into trouble as their sledges failed after 50 miles, and that was November 1st. So then this team was forced to manhaul everything from there. Now catching back up with Amundsen quickly, it's November 5th now, and he's reached their final depot. They would now have to find their way through the transantarctic mountains, and this led some difficult days of scouting footholds and deep powdered snow. Finally, after a serious climb, they reached what Amundsen would name the Alex Heiber Glacier, named after one of his chief financial backers. So on November 21st, they reached the top. They'd climbed over 10,000 feet high. God damn, these fellas are tough as nails. Not to mention their sled dogs. These dogs sound almost like mythical creatures in their ability to endure the cold and pull these sleds. They were 85 degrees south. Coincidentally, on that same day, November 21st, many miles to the east, the part of the Terra Nova crew that was supported by ponies and dogs met up with the main party. Then they ran into a blizzard before they could make their descent up the Beardmore Glacier, leave them stuck there where they were to camp until December 9th. Not great luck for the Terra Nova crew. So back to Amundsen's crew. We're still around November 21st, you know, dial it back a little bit. And this part is sad. This part's really sad because I love dogs. But now they would prepare for the final journey to the pole. And in doing so, they would kill all but 18 of the now 45 dogs they had brought this far. What the fuck? So they were needed for food, apparently. These men weren't just cold calculated, though. I mean, they weren't blind to the sadness of all this. Each sledge driver would have to kill dogs from his own team. And from this sad day, they called the area the butcher shop. They had all grown very fond of these dogs, and the need to do this apparently left them really depressed about the whole situation. I would have turned around. Fuck that. Whipper, Snapper, Ripper, Clapper, and Handsome Bob would lead me back to camp, and they'd be alive. And yeah, those are my dogs, hypothetically, in this situation. So, the party then loaded up their sledges with supplies for the next part of the journey. They waited for good weather until November 25th, and then set off again south. The area they were now going through was very foggy and filled with crevasses. They actually passed over an area where crevasses were concealed under the snow, and they could hear an unpleasantly hollow sound as they passed over. This area was then called the Devil's Glacier and the Devil's Ballroom for the area where with the concealed crevasses. And December 8th marked an important victory for the Norwegian expedition. They passed Arnold Shackleton's record of 88 degrees south. So this would be the day before the Terra Nova crew would even start their ascent up the Beardmore Glacier. So Amundsen and his crew are clearly on their way to victory. And just like that, by December 14th, 1911, Amundsen led his team as they passed into the vicinity of the South Pole. They planted the Norwegian flag and were victorious in being the first recorded humans to reach the pole. December 20th, the Terra Nova crew, so this is 6 days later, 1911, the Terra Nova crew, unaware that they'd already been beaten to the South Pole, would finally have to ascend the Beardmore Glacier and now arrive at their final depot. They sent some men back at this point and would continue on with an 8-man party, including Scott, only to shed 3 more men on December 30th and have them return with the rest of the party to Cape Evans. That kind of sucks. 3 guys had to go off on their own. But Amundsen's team had turned back to Fraunhammer on December 18th. The journey back proved fairly uneventful, and they made really good time. All told, the round trip to the pole and back for Fraunheim took 99 days and covered 1,860 nautical miles. As these different expeditions took separate routes to, they had base camps many miles apart, they never actually saw each other on their way to or from the pole. So anyway, now Scott and his team continued south, and on January 16th would spot the flag that Roald Amundsen had placed just nearly exactly a month prior. That had to be gut-wrenching. I can't imagine that feeling, to undergo such a struggle to find yourself in second place. Still, though, it was an achievement. It was a great achievement. Ouch. Scott apparently still held out hope that he could still achieve some fame by sending out a telegraph first. I mean, okay, maybe for the news and notoriety, but they get some fame. But on the way, long run, still, you're second place, man. Come on. Scott planted a flag for Britain and would then begin their march home. Unfortunately for him and the 4 that were with him, this march would prove fatal. And the first to die would be Edgar Evans, whose health had already been deteriorating. He collapsed and died on February 17th, 1912. By February 27th, they had only made it to 82 degrees south, heading north, and knowing that meant winter was coming, they had to move. They dealt with harsh winds and very cold temperatures. They had planned to meet up with the dog team, but when they arrived at the planned meeting point, the dogs and their sled driver were not there. Here's a note from Scott's diary that was recovered later. "The dogs, which would have been our salvation, have evidently failed. Miraz, the dog driver, had a bad trip home, I suppose." Scott would then go on to ensure that the rest of the crew of the expedition were not blamed for not meeting up. He thinks they might have overshot their meeting place and wanted no one else to take the blame. One member of the remaining 4, Oates, then got frostbite. Because of this and the worsening condition, the march dwindled down to 5 miles a day. Oates suffering worse every day and probably not wanting to put his friend's life into jeopardy any further, he just bravely just left his tent and walked into the cold to his death. He told the crew as he left the tent, "I'm just going outside and I may be some time." Ooh, damn. These are some brave fellas. Yikes. The remaining 3 would continue without Oates to slow them down, but after a while longer, it was too late. Scott had frostbite, blizzard set in, and they were stuck. It was over. Here's Robert Falcon Scott's last diary entry. "Every day we have been ready to start for our depot 11 miles away, but outside of the door of the tent, it remains a scene of whirling drift. I do not think we can hope for any better things now. We shall stick it out to the end, but we are getting weaker. Of course, and the end cannot be far. It seems a pity, but I do not think I can write more. R. Scott, last entry. For God's sake, look after our people. Wow. So anyway, back to Amundsen's party really quick. It will now be back to on January 7th. Scott's team hadn't even reached the South Pole at this point, and Amundsen's crew arrived back to Framheim. They made really good time returning home, partly because of the trekking down the mountain went just really fast and going up, and they didn't have to, you know, they had a path charted, you know. 2 days later, on January 9th, the Kanan Maru, led by Nobu Shirase, had showed up, and they met with Amundsen's crew, actually. Apparently, they had difficulties communicating due to the language barrier. I wonder if Amundsen tried to explain that he reached the South Pole. Yeah, I won! Anyway, I would imagine he did. The Kanan Maru would then go on to make their successful landing at King Edward's Seven Land. Kind of makes me think that Shirase was definitely informed that Amundsen already made it to the poles, and he went to that island instead. And Amundsen and his crew departed Antarctica on January 30th, 1912, and would head for Tasmania, where they could resupply and send telegrams home. Much later that year, the remaining British team would send out a search party. It'd be October. You know, this was, you know, many months later, and they would find the tent that Scott and the other two from his crew, Wilson and Bowers, were with him. The British crew would stay at their camp until they left around January of 1913. So they left a whole year later. And that was that. Amundsen won. He received all kinds of congratulatory telegrams, even from the likes of Theodore Roosevelt and King George V of the United Kingdom. Amundsen was cheered, and really, even despite his deceit about going to the South Pole instead of North, even the British would give him a great deal of credit. The deaths of the Terra Nova expedition would overshadow their expedition's real achievements. They hadn't just gone to an Antarctica to race to the pole, after all. They were there to conduct research, and they didn't squander their time there. They made important discoveries in zoology, geology, and botany. They brought home 2,100 plants, animals, and fossils. They even found a fossil of a plant that had been around, been from Australia, New Zealand, and Africa and India. This helped support the theory that Antarctica was not always so cold, and also that it was once part of a larger connected landmass. So these explorers all left a legacy for their work in the Antarctic, paving the way for other explorers. Before we close out, I want to mention some of the more recent research that's been done in Antarctica and what's going on there now. You know, sure, we discover it, but what are we doing there at this point? In 1986, there's research teams there that would study the hole in the ozone layer, and that's how they discovered that it was caused by CFCs. And then in 1991, a 25-foot long rock was discovered only 350 miles from the South Pole, and that would prove that dinosaurs had existed on all continents. And in 2022, researchers discovered a previously unknown ecosystem in an underground river deep below the Larsen ice shelf, containing thousands of tiny crustaceans called amphipods. That same year, they discovered that ancient wildfires had happened on the continent. And today, the status of Antarctica, as far as ownership, is it's governed by the Antarctic Treaty System, which is one of a kind in its that it's an international agreement that regulates the use and governance of the entire continent. And the agreement ensures scientific freedom and cooperation, as well as a ban on any kind of military activity. Environmental protection was also part of this agreement, and they also have rules that allow countries to freely inspect each other's facilities for compliance. So, and speaking of facilities, there are dozens of research facilities located all over the continent. Some are year-round facilities and others are seasonal. One thing that is sure is that research and discovery, it still continues on this continent. It was the last continent discovered, and it was, you know, it's just so recent, really. It's kind of wild. It makes you feel closer to history, though, doesn't it? I mean, I, for one, am a fan of Antarctica, and especially the penguins. Okay, now I think it's time we wrap this up and review our cast of characters from today's episode. Okay, our characters on today's show include Homo antecessor, the early proto-humans who might have been the first of our kind to experience brutal cold winter months. And there's the Babylonians, of course, the ancient culture whom we amazingly still use many of their cultural norms today, especially regarding timekeeping. And then, of course, the Mayans, who were excellent astronomers, mathematicians, and timekeepers. Aristarchus of Samos, he is the Greek astronomer who made the first heliocentric model. And there was Nicholas Copernicus, who would then come along and prove Antarctus right, correct? There was Romulus, and then later Julius Caesar, who would contribute to how our calendar looks today. Peter Henlein, who should probably maybe get the credit for the first wristwatch or pocket clock. It seems a shame that this wasn't more definitive for that poor guy. There was Prince-Elector August von Sachsen, who should maybe be credited for owning the first known Google clock. Or maybe he just brought him into style, you know. I mean, quite the legacy indeed, good sir. An Anaximander, Nicadius, for basically being the grandfather and father of geography, respectively. John Harrison, creator of the marine chronometer to help ships navigate at sea. Guy basically just rebranded the clock, right? But whatever. I mean, it worked well. It was a good idea. Ernest Shackleton, who led his own expedition to the South Pole and came within 100 miles before having to turn back. Roald Amundsen, who will forever be the first person to reach the South Pole, recorded, and really one of the last great explorers on Earth. There were definitely modern humans that hadn't made it yet, but as far as continental exploration, this was kind of the last frontier on land. He deserves a lot of credit for his achievement there. And then finally, Robert Falcon Scott. He was criticized for his inability to fully embrace the use of sled dogs and for some of the decisions that just didn't go his way. Sure, the sled dog criticism seems kind of accurate. I mean, sled dogs, when handled correctly, seem to be very helpful for Roald Amundsen. And this also might have cost him the race, you know. Other than this detail, though, I found Scott to be an honorable guy. I mean, really, this story could have easily gone another way. We shouldn't act like chance didn't have a lot to do with the way this played out. I mean, this easily could have been about a Norwegian who tricked his crew and led them to misery and death while chasing glory. Robert Falcon Scott, although ultimately failing to be the first to the South Pole, did not waste the time he had on this earth. And so I'll leave you with this quote from Robert Falcon Scott. We took risks. We knew we took them. Things have come out against us, and therefore we have no cause for complaint. But bow to the will of Providence, determined still to do our best to the last. And that was Robert Falcon Scott. All right. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to leave corrections or feedback to feedback@meridianspodcast.com. This show is currently released every other week, and please consider subscribing if you haven't already. Can't hurt, right? Maybe you have a road trip coming up. Might be handy to have some options for a podcast, eh? Maybe you need something to drown you out while you mow your lawn. Take some boredom out of life. Thanks again, and see you next time. Till then, from across the universe, I'm Charlie Noble. Thank you to Jenny, Julian, Miss Becky, Elton John, Danny DeVito, Carl Weathers, the elevator attendants, asphalt workers, Gore-Tex, Timex, Rolex, Spandex.